Portland, Oregon in March, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in April, Palm Springs, California in June. And I'm not going to Billings, Montana this year at all. I learned how to say it, though. But beyond that, I don't know. But there's always that call. There's always that email that you never know where you're going to go. You just don't know. But I'm not going to Billings, Montana this year. I used to say Montana, and now I've learned it's Montana. Montana. Billings, Montana is correct. Billings, Montana is incorrect. 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 Just like when I moved to Eugene, Oregon for 9 years, I had no idea that it wasn't Oregon. But if you say Oregon up there, they'll come burn your house down. They don't let... Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah, I had no idea that it, you know, because we even learned in school, you know, that it was Oregon, and it's not. It's Oregon. I didn't know that. And now I'll tell you something about that since we're talking about pronunciation. No, we're not really, but I'll just throw this out there to you. I can tell you who's from Chicago and who's not, because what they'll say is Chicago. I don't talk like that. I say Chicago. And we never refer to it as the Windy City or Chi-Town, but outsiders do. They'll say, oh, you're from Chi-Town? Oh, you're not. Well, we don't talk like that. We don't refer to it as that. We don't sit and say, yes, I'm from the Windy City. We don't say that. So if they say, are you from the Windy City? I'll say, yes, but you're not. Montana. Now, the ladies behind you can review this. Benji, Montana, correct? Okay, all right. Montana? Montana, okay. There you go, see? There's Joe Montana in Billings, Montana. All right, see, mine too. But all of a sudden, I started, when I came to the second time to their thing last summer, I started hearing it. It's not Montana, it's Montana. Okay. Little things that mean nothing. My mother used to say, if all this information about the Three Stooges and wrestling and cartoons was valuable, you could be a millionaire. We're going to start a little later because we want to give the people a chance to get from the breakfast speaker in here, so we'll start at 9:15. I promise I will have you at the closing. I've learned my lesson. I got too long-winded 1 year, and the whole big book group missed the closing, and there was like a whole people were chasing me down the street, and it was ugly. It got ugly. What time does that start? Noon here? Noon, okay. Every once in a while, Howard S. will rope me into doing a phone thing, and I just did one for somebody else called the Vision for You group or something. I was one of the something speakers. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, every once in a while, they'll call me and say, can you do one? Is it 9:15 yet? Is that why they're coming in here? 9:06. I'm good. Okay. I just figured it was courteous to let them come from the breakfast speaker. You have to... All right. So I'll wait. Okay. All right. Thanks. Montana. Resentments and anger will trigger the mental twist. The mental twist will drive you irresistibly into the food in search of the effect. because the resentment is causing a disturbance in your mental twist. The resentment is causing your mental twist to just go crazy. And the only thing it knows that will make you feel better is food. And it's trying to make you feel better. And it will for about 8 seconds. But then there's the mental block, the mental blank spot that blocks out the fact that every time you eat a piece of cake, you eat the whole cake. That every time you eat 4 pistachio nuts, you eat all the pistachio nuts. Your mental blank spot cannot lock in on that. It just says, eat the cake, and then you eat it and you trigger the allergy. You'll pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to do that again, and you will repeat that cycle over and over and over again, the mind telling you that the cake's okay and the body ensuring that it's not. And so this is how fear, resentment, selfishness, self-seeking, and anger kill you. There's only one letter difference between anger and danger. And so anger, fear, selfish, self-seeking, dishonesty, guilt, shame, remorse, happiness, depression, elation will trigger that mental twist because the mental twist is trying to kind of even you out and make you feel better. And that mental twist it doesn't have the ability to focus in on what the food does to you. It only sees what the food will do for you, and it doesn't have that knowledge of the allergy or the destructive force that the food will rot into your life. And food is an unmerciful terrorist. It's unmerciful. It doesn't care who you are. It doesn't care whether you're black, white, green, yellow, tall, short, Jew, Gentile. It doesn't care who you are. It will come into your life and it will ransack you. And so the only choices we have are eat, recover. There's no choice C. So that's how those resentments will kill you. That's specifically the machinery of what's been going on. Is it 9:15 yet, though? All right, 5 more minutes, and then it's Go Ducks time. Okay. Go Ducks. I did. I said to them, Go Ducks, and they didn't like it.
No.
Wow. Yeah. I've seen when I lived in Eugene, and I've seen them play rugby. Man, those guys are crazy. Those guys are nuts. You got to be crazy. Yes, with all the equipment and everything, sure. If you're just coming in, we're just going to wait till 9:15 because people are unsettled as to how to find us from the breakfast meeting and they're not quite sure where we're at, and so we're going to give it a few minutes. If you care to, if you care to. Sunday morning is usually the thinnest group, lowest number. Yeah, people go home, people have to catch flights, people want to see the 49ers. You know. Yes, it is the most intimate. Yes. Yes, my hip insists, this one insists that I have not yet, but I'll tell it to quiet down. Oh, thank you. Thank you. I couldn't have done it without my assistant, Leslie, keeping me on track there. Now that George is not here for this one, she stepped in remarkably well. What's scary is sometimes I'll look up in the middle of a sentence, and then as God is my judge, I have no idea where the heck I am. And I'm thinking, should I just drink the Drano now, or should I just go home and down a thing, a liquid plumber, and just get it over with, be done with it? I mean, I don't like it. It's like, what? Because this didn't happen to me years ago. I mean, but now it's like, what the heck? What's funny is I can remember very distinctly what teachers we had for what subjects in freshman year, sophomore year. I can remember sights and sounds of high school and grammar school, but yet somebody that I met yesterday just came up to me in the hall, and I couldn't read their name tag. Ellie, I couldn't remember this person's name. If you gave me $1 million, I couldn't tell you what their name was. And it's embarrassing. I don't like it. It's like I have to keep a pen and write on my hand. Fred, Linda, Joe. I mean, it's crazy. I know, but man, I used to not be like this. I can remember conversations from 1967 easier than I can remember what we had for lunch yesterday. Why is this? That part of your brain is very, very exercised. And this is a much bigger subject to us than it is to normal people. Normal people, food has the same relationship that you have with the gasoline in the tank of your automobile. They fill it, they don't, whatever, they don't sit and obsess about it, they don't, you know, whatever. To us, it's like this, and to them, it's like this. I have a friend, Scott Goldberg, and Scott owns a business where they buy and sell produce and stuff. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He would tell you, he'll say something like, you know, I got real busy yesterday and I never ate lunch. No wonder I'm hungry. Does anybody have a power drill? I just want to... I said, if I didn't like Nicole and the kids, I would just kill you. If I didn't love your wife and kids, I would just kill you. I would saw your head off, and that would be the end of it. You'd never tell me this. He'll say something like, you know, I got so damn busy, I didn't eat dinner yesterday. And I'll go, I got so damn busy, I hit you with a hammer. 9:15, it's time to go. Okay. Now I'm going to give you all a compliment. Sunday morning is usually the thinnest group. We have been talking for our sessions about causes and conditions. And yesterday we talked about the third and the fourth step as being the most misunderstood steps. The third step is a very misunderstood step. People go in and they'll say things at meetings like, oh, I turned that over to God. No, unless you did a fourth step inventory on it, and unless you made amends on it, unless you told that to somebody else, made amends for it, worked it out with God, using the steps, you have not turned over anything to anyone. I do not turn anything over to God by just uttering the third step prayer. The third step prayer is very beautiful, but that doesn't turn anything over to anyone. There are three frogs, and they're sitting on a log, and one of the frogs makes a decision to jump off the log. How many frogs are on the log? Three. Because a mere decision to jump off the log will not get that frog's rump off the log. I have to take action. And if there's anything I have said repeatedly since I got to the birthday celebration, it's that this is not a program for people who need it. It is not a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. And it is an action program. And the fourth step, which we looked at, is a very, very easy step. What's required is a desire to do it. I have to have that willingness to do it. I have to have that desire. And that desire comes from beginning to end. It never gets away from the ABCs. Just in review, A, that I am a compulsive overeater and that I cannot manage my own life. I must be convinced of these things. I must be convinced that I am a compulsive overeater and that I cannot manage my own life. And just to kind of review what we talked about yesterday, there are people in meetings that are identifying themselves as compulsive overeaters, and I've heard them and so have you, and I've done it and probably so have you, without a knowledge of what that is. A compulsive overeater, as described by the doctor's opinion in the first four chapters, is a person who has a strange mental twist. And the strange mental twist will activate when I am happy, sad, fearful, angry, dishonest, guilt, shame, remorse, selfish, self-seeking. When those emotions are running around in my heart, it is going to trigger the mental twist, because the mental twist is trying to make me feel better. Remember we talked about yesterday, seems like a million years ago, but we talked about this yesterday, that the mental twist will drive me into the food, not in search of what the food will do to me, but what the food will do for me. That the food does something for me that it does not do for the normal temperate eater. And food will instantly produce the effect. The effect is the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by eating the food. I eat the food, and unfortunately, every single time I eat the food, I will trigger the physical allergy. The physical allergy is the adverse, abnormal reaction to the food, beverage, or substance. Adverse. It's harmful. Abnormal. 9 out of 10 people do not have it. When a normal person eats, and we just got through talking about this, when a normal person eats food, they have the same relationship with food that I have with the gasoline in my automobile. When I go to the store and I buy gasoline for my car, I do not try to convince the attendant that I'm having some sort of gasoline party at the house, and that's why I'm buying so much gasoline. When I buy gasoline for my car, I do not run hither and yon. Yiddish word of the day can be spatzering. Spatzering means to run around for different things. I don't spatzer, run around to different gasoline stations so that no one will know me and I won't be embarrassed about the amount of gasoline I'm putting in my car, nor do I run around in the middle of the night sneaking in a quart here or sneaking in a gallon there so that no one will see me. I don't do those things because I have a normal relationship with gasoline in my car. Not so with food. With food, and we were talking about the relationship that normal people have, it will produce that effect. It will produce that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by eating the food. Now, I also have a mental blank spot. What is the mental blank spot? The mental blank spot will push aside any thought of the binge from a day, an hour, a week, a month ago. When I was about 10 years old, I cut my finger really badly, really badly. I cut my finger. And my finger bled like I was bleeding like you would not believe. Since that day, and if you give me a quarter, I'll even show you my scar. I have it right here. But anyway, since that day, and because now I'm old and I'm on Pradaxa for a blood thinner because I have atrial fibrillation of the heart, who thinks like, I have atrial, this is like for something old people get. And I thought I was still like 8 years old. What the hell? Anyway, not just because I'm on Pradaxa and not just because I'm 58 years old, but I am very, very careful around knives. When I cut food or I'm cutting something, I'm very, very careful. I don't want to cut myself again. Food has burned me and cut me and amputated me and has mangled me much worse than that knife could have done had I stuck it in my neck. But the mental blank spot that pushes aside what the food does to me to allow the mental twist to focus in on what the food will do for me is an incredible machine. And no amount of my willpower is going to negate the effect of the mental blank spot. So we're seeing the machinery of how this kills. A, that we were compulsive overeaters and could not manage our own lives. Can't eat because of the allergy. Can't keep from eating because of the mental twist. Don't see what the food is doing to me because of the mental blank spot. Feel what the food is doing for me because of the effect. Food in my body will change my perception of reality. Roy is sober. He is not altered because he hasn't eaten Oreo cookies today. If he ate Oreo cookies, I cannot rely on anything that he tells me. Everything he tells me is from the mind of a drunk. Because in his body, in his soul, Oreo cookies will change his perception of reality. We distort and diminish. We distort and diminish. Okay. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. This is key, and we've been talking about the fourth step, and we've been talking about the third step. Now let's go back to the second step, that there is nothing here on this earth that is going to change this. And again and again and again and again we are told, and again we will resist this thought. And here's the thought, that only the working of the steps by marshaling the power of this God, whatever that God is for you, it is not up to me to describe what God is for you. But this God that you have in your heart, this God that you have to have, that you do believe in, is something that is precious and vital, because without it you cannot recover. Money is not going to recover for you. Sex is not going to recover for you, I'm told. Relationships, people drinking, people not drinking, people standing on their head, people not standing on their head is not going to do it for you, and that God could and would if he were sought. And we talked yesterday about the third and the fourth step. But again, I just want to reiterate that nothing of what we're going to talk about this morning, about the amends, nothing we're going to talk about today can stand on anything but a firm foundation. And the foundation is this belief, this to the soul belief that is not going to come in an instant. I have to work at it. But this belief that God can and will relieve my compulsion. That God does love me. That God does care about me. The step five instructions, because we've been talking about steps three and four, but the step five instructions comes from a chapter whose title I love. It's not into thinking. It's not into praying. It's not into hoping, it's into action. I don't know if I've said this since I came to California. Stop me if you've heard this before. This is not a program for people who need it. This is not a program for people who want it. This is a program for people who do it. He works his butt off at recovery. He runs meetings. He helps people. He travels. He does things. That's why he's abstinent. Not because of the hat he's wearing or his Miami sweatshirt. Not because of any of those things. Okay? Into action. We choose somebody to listen to our fourth step, and there are two things which what I would say are the most important. Are they sober? And are they educated? And when I say sober and educated, I don't mean sober and a Princeton graduate or something. What I mean is, do they know the program? The most important thing we have to understand is that that person is probably not going to change anything in column 1-2. Probably not going to change too much in column 3. Maybe here and there, not too much. what they're going to be helpful on, what they're going to be life-giving on, is their ability to help me see column four. Column one in the resentments. Who or what do I resent? Column two, what did I do to them in 19 words or less, please? Column three, what part of self is affected? And column four is, what did I do based on the defects of character to set the ball in motion? And they're probably not going to change very much in anything except column four. They're going to enlighten me. They're going to educate me as to what is going on with my part in things, because I'm so blinded by my ego and I'm so blinded by my defects of character. And if I replay these resentments in my head enough times, I really see that I was just this poor, innocent victim, and you came along and you did me dirt. Now, here is something else that's very important about the instructions in step five. I must pick somebody who will be unaffected. Now, let's just say, for example, that I am doing a fifth step, and I am doing that with Ellie. Ellie is the person that I've chosen to do my fifth step. Ellie is sober. Ellie is educated. She's in program. She's working her steps. And I've decided to do it with Ellie. Now, let's just say, for example, that I know very well that I have a resentment against Ellie's best friend. Ellie's best friend is somebody that is number 21 on my resentment list. Automatically, she is not the one to hear my fifth step, because you must choose somebody who will be unaffected. It is not fair of me to dump a truckload of dreck onto her knowing that she is going to be affected. That is not okay. And so it's very, very important that I pick somebody who is sober, I pick somebody who is educated, and I pick somebody who will be unaffected. In certain circumstances, especially when the book came out, people could not be found that were in this way of life. And so some people are comfortable doing it with a clergyman. Some people are comfortable doing it with their physician, or they're comfortable doing it with whomever. And that's fine. There's no wrong way to do it. The wrong way to do it is to do it, or excuse me, the wrong thing is not to do it at all. I would not suggest that that is as true today. If you want to go do it with your clergyman or your physician, go ahead. But the bottom, I'm sorry, go for it. Nem gesunter hate means go and do it. But sorry. But the bottom line is that this is very different today, in that in AA, there is some, if you can't find somebody in OA, don't be afraid to go look at somebody in AA. They use the same book we do, and if they want to stay sober, they will probably be of help to you, and they will probably do that. Let's go to the bottom of 75. And these are very specific instructions. And once again, I don't know, stop me if I may have said this since I've been to California. This is one of the reasons you can't recover out of the 12 and 12. This is one of the reasons that I can't recover out of any other form of literature, because this is the only literature that has the specific instructions of what to do and what not to do. This is the only thing that has this. Okay? So at the bottom of 75, it tells me, returning home, this is after I'm done with the fifth step, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. And that means no cell phones, no TV, no radio, no movies, no nothing. Quiet. Carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps, page 59. Carefully reading the first five proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? And this is a very beautiful moment. This is a very, very beautiful moment. And one of the most beautiful things about the steps are that it made me feel more like a human being than anything else could have. It allowed me to look the world in the eye. And as you do your fifth step, and as you take fifth steps from other people, I know some of you are sponsors, it makes you feel more human. And what happens is you start understanding the value of, yes, me too, me too. Because we think we're so unique. We think we're so special. Let me tell you something. I've taken a lot of fifth steps. I've done a lot of fifth steps. I've taken a lot of fifth steps. There's really nothing you're going to tell me I probably haven't heard a million times before. And I know that many of the other sponsors in the room will tell you the same thing. But it just helps to know that I'm telling this stuff to another person and they're not just fainting. They're not just passing out. We can look the world in the eye. Prior to program, I knew how to look down at you. Prior to program, I knew how to look up to you. Now in program, I can look at you. I can talk to you. And there are three ultimate byproducts of this work, all the work. Number one, I'll be right with God. Number two, I'll be right with myself. And number three, I'll be right with my fellow human being. And that's so important. Because God put me in this world to live in it, not apart from it. If He didn't want me to be part of the world, He wouldn't have put me here. If He didn't want me to be part of the world, He wouldn't have given me the book. He wouldn't have given me the program. Now, the two shortest presentations of steps in the big book are two of the most unbelievable, unbelievable steps, and they are 6 and 7. And we look at those things when we first come in, if you're anything like me, and you see these steps hanging from the wall. And I went from not believing I had any character defects, because I was sitting in the back of the room at 600 pounds or whatever I was at the time, and I smelled like a zoo, and you know, I was crapping in my pants, and the money in my pocket was because I had written bad checks, and you know, I had the shiniest steering wheel in Illinois because it butted up against one of my stomachs, and I had a broken seat in my Chevrolet Suburban, and I was living in the same pair of 80 pants for, you know, like 2 years, and every shirt I had couldn't button, and I was a mess. I was an absolute mess. Every t-shirt I wore had food and cigarette stains, you know, from the burning cigarettes and the food stains down the front. And I couldn't figure out why I couldn't get a girlfriend. It was really baffling to me. It was really quite baffling to me. I really didn't get it. And I looked at these and I looked at these and I started working the program. And all of a sudden I went from not believing that I had character defects, but to understanding that I do have character defects. And that these character defects are ransacking my life. And that when I see the destructiveness of the anger, and I see the destructiveness of the fear and the sexual harms done others, and I see the destructiveness of my selfishness and my self-seeking and my dishonesty, my God, I lied when the truth would have served me better. It was almost as if I was walking down the street one day and God said, I want to introduce you to my friend Harlan. And I said, Harlan, it's nice to meet you. I'm Harlan. Because I never understood who I was. Because in my mind, it just all made sense. My God, the energy that I've wasted in my life. Telling lies, lying to Ellie, then lying to Leslie. And oh my God, they're sitting next to each other here in the front row. And after all, because of my selfishness, self-seeking, and dishonesty and all they're going to talk about is me, right? So that they're going to find out I told Leslie Green and I told Ellie Blue, and now they're sitting. And the worry and the fear and the concern that would cause me, oh my God. When I was a little kid, I don't know why I remember this, but I do. When I was in like third grade, we had a science book. And for some reason, this just stuck in my little brain. They had a demonstration that the human heart in the first 60 years of life does enough work to lift a battleship a foot out of the water. If I could harness the energy I have spent lying, stealing, avoiding work, avoiding life, I could lift that battleship 29 miles in the air and throw it over my shoulder, for God's sakes. The illness is exhausting. It's an exhausting way to live. And here we see in step 4, in step 5, the destructive nature of these defects. This is another example of how the steps are perfectly in order. Did I do something wrong? Okay. That the steps are perfectly in order. I couldn't do steps 1, 2, 6, and 7 because I wouldn't see in front of me what the defects did in my life and the unbelievable destruction that was wrought into my life as the result of them. 6, page 76. If we can answer to our satisfaction when we look at step 6, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. And what step do you think you need to lean on there? Step 2. If I don't have that God in my life, then I'm not going to trust that if I operate my business life honestly, if I operate my personal life honestly, and I operate my recovery life honestly, that I'll be okay. Because my inclination is as a human being to try to force feed my will into any scenario. Can I operate my business honestly? Because they're not just asking me to be honest when it comes to food and program. They're going to ask me to be honest in every area of my life. My friend Della F. in Chicago says if all the food did was make you fat, it wouldn't be so bad. But the illness permeates every cell of our being. Step 7. When ready, we say something like this. Don't make me say this alone. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have completed step 7. I want to live honestly. I want to live without that selfishness and that self-seeking. I want to live without that exhaustive tumult in my head of how I'm going to get what I want. I don't want what I want. I want what God wants. Now, every single time that I go to a step study meeting, other than some, but most of the time, it's very hard for the group to discuss step 8. Even in the book, it says steps 8 and 9. But step 8 is a very definite and distinct step apart from 9. Because there are some people that I cannot make amends to. They're dead. I can't find them or whatever. Step 8 for me is a very, very important step. And before I run into 9, what I have to remember that is so, so important for me is that without step 2, and I know I've said this before, I'm not going to go through with this, but I have to make a list of all the persons we had harmed. You know when I did that? When I did step 4. When I do step 4, I have a list of the people that I have resentments against. I have a list of people that I fear. I have a list of the sexual harms done others. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I have to be willing. And it is very, very important for me to remember that before I proceed into step 9. And again, there's going to be a very, very distinct instruction here that is so important. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others, is step 9. What about the amends that I cannot make of this earth? I blamed my mother for everything. She was the bane of my existence. I wanted Robin Laura Petrie. I wanted a young, rich, talented American parents. I wanted parents that looked and danced and sang like Robin Laura. That's what I wanted. And I got Max and Virginia Grabowski. Very different. And I got Max and Virginia Grabowski, and I blamed my mother for every single thing in my life that went wrong. The biggest source of joy in my life was her crying. The biggest source of unhappiness in my life was her joy. When she was unhappy, I was euphoric. If I could make her cry, I did. I took anything and everything out on her. And for decades of my life, I felt very, very cheated because I had an overweight, crazy, mentally ill mom who died when I was 22, but who was essentially lost to me when I was a little child. If I could have walked 1 mile to please her or 100 miles to hurt her, I would have walked the 100 miles gladly. How do you make amends for that? How do you make amends for eating railroad cars full of Kit Kat bars even after she's dead, knowing somehow, some way, F you, Mom, and I'm getting that revisited in my life today because I have an 18-year-old as of today that doesn't speak to me. I have an 18-year-old child today, and that's coming back to haunt me because I've spent 1 hour with this child in almost 3 years, and she believes that about me today, so it's funny how these things come back to you. But what I had to do was I had to see that these amends had to be made, and I did not want to make those amends to my crazy mother. And for years, I worked on it, and I worked on it, and I did these steps again, and I did them again, and I did them again. And what finally started to happen in my life is that after doing the steps a zillion times, what happened in my life is I started to get a glimmer of the vision that I didn't choose my parents. I started to get a glimmer of the vision that it was not my doing that my mother was who she was. And something very, very special happened on December the 14th, 1994. I had a daughter, the same one who doesn't speak to me, and I carried my little girl into the neonatal intensive care unit at Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene, Oregon. And I put my little daughter about 15 minutes after she was born, and she was born under horrific conditions. My then wife was deathly ill. She had the same hyperemesis gravis that the princess has. She was hospitalized for the vomiting and the pregnancy. And she was very sick. My wife was passing ketones. She was on all kinds of medication. We didn't know what that was going to do to my daughter. And they told us that there was a chance that my daughter would be blind, deaf, with cerebral palsy. We were prepared for the worst. We were 3,000 miles from home. I was making a lot of money in Oregon. That's why we moved there. But how many? It's not going to save you. It's not going to help you. And I carried my daughter into the neonatal intensive care unit, and they were hooking her up to needles and stuff. And the most effective way to get medication into an infant is through the feet and the head. And it's not through the arms; it's through the feet and the head. And she's in there, and she's in her little isolette, and bam! I got it. It came to me in an instant. I love you, Mom. I forgive you. I saw in my child, I saw in that baby how much I hurt you, Mom. I saw how much this hurt you. I now know what it's like to be you. I know now what it's like to have a child. I know now what it's like that when I yelled at you and I screamed at you and I told you you were dirt and you were garbage and you were crazy, how much it hurt you. And in that instant, I stopped thinking about the fact that I didn't choose my mother. I started thinking about the fact that she didn't choose her mental illness either. And I stopped focusing on what I lost out on, and I started having some understanding of what she lost out on by having a child that hated her and by having this mental illness, because inside of her there was good. Inside of her there was an educated, articulate person who was absolutely overwhelmed with mental illness. And from that day unto this day, I make amends to her and I write her letters. The first few letters I wrote to her with my sponsor, he tore them up in my face. He says, these are not letters of amends. These are indictments. He says, this is an indictment. He says, he tore it up right in front of me. And now I write her letters, and now when I live, and now when I recover, I know that she's with me, and I know that she's happy. How do you make amends for that? There's three things I can do for my mother every day. Recover, recover, and recover. That's everything she ever wanted. That her last conversation with me on this earth was, please, Harlan, find a way not to eat so much. My father has been dead for 35 years. Died in 76, 37 years. 37 years? 37, thanks. Math was not my good subject there. And I loved my father. But there were a lot of things that I just felt cheated on. As I told you, I wanted Rob Petrie. I didn't get that. I got Max Grabowski. I got an angry dad. I got an older dad. My dad was 54 years old on the day I was born. He was 60 when I entered kindergarten. There were things I couldn't do with him. I never rode bikes with him. I never played ball with him. And he was out of it. He was done. He was done. You read these books about all these people and how they did this, and that wasn't him. He was done. He was long done. And he was bitter, and he was scared. Oh, he was so scared. He knew, especially like any time there was a holiday, like Christmas or Easter, they're coming to kill us. And when Ruby killed Oswald in 63, oh, that's it. They're coming to kill us now. That's the end of that. Ruby killed Oswald. They're going to kill us now. Get ready. So he was always with that sword of Damocles hanging over our heads. And I loved him. How do I make amends for the way I hurt him? How do I make amends for disappointing him? I can recover. I can recover. And I can recover. One little other quick story about amends. Very, very important. This was in the 1980s. This is after I had graduated from OA and I had went to the beautiful ceremony, and they said, of course, welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order, please? And I said, yes, and make sure it's a supersized fries and a chocolate shake. And I got a Coke to pour in the shake and a Diet Coke to make sure nobody knew I was overeating. And the bottom line is that I went to a dentist. I had a hot tooth. A hot tooth is a tooth where the nerve is dying and it hurts like a son of a, and it doesn't hurt. And you think you're done. You think you've gone. And then it comes back. And then it comes back. Anyway, I went to this dentist on Lincoln in California. You Chicagoans listening to the tape, or you Chicagoans in the room, know that that's right by Mather High School, right where I went to school. I went to this dentist. Oh, I was out of high school by then. I graduated in 72. But anyway, I went to this dentist, and he's working on my tooth, and all of a sudden, now I am probably 500-600 pounds at this time in my life, if I'm an ounce. And when he sat me down, he said, I hope you don't break my chair. That's all he said. Sure enough, I broke his chair. Sure enough, I'd broken a lot of furniture in my life. I smashed couches. I got stuck in cars. I've split my pants. I have broken a lot of things with my weight. There were things I couldn't do, things I couldn't, I couldn't sit on. And it seemed that if I did go to someone's house, they all had a very special chair that they were saving just for me. You know how that goes. Anyway, I broke his chair. Now I'm numb in the jaw. And now he is screaming at me like the adults did when I was a child. This guy is enraged. He is telling me, how could you be so fat? What's wrong with you? Then he started screaming at his daughter. His daughter ran the office, and he started screaming, you get Harlan Grabowski's file ready. You are never to come back to me. I never want you in my office again. I just spent $2,500 on this chair to get it fixed, and then you came in and you broke it. He said, look at you. You're obese. Look at you. You're obese. Look, he said it like three or four times. He says, you look like a horse. And he now, what I do when people did that to me is I would just shut down emotionally. There's nothing to say. What am I going to do? No, I'm skinny. No, what are you going to say to him? You know, no matter what the situation is, if you're fat, your position becomes indefensible. So if a thin person says 2 and 2 is 7 and a fat person says 2 and 2 is 4, the thin person wins because they can trump you by saying, yeah, but you're fat. You have no comeback for that. Okay? So now he is screaming at me, and I had insurance. I was in radio at that time, and I had insurance, and my part of the bill was $65. Well, you know what that guy could do for $65, right? I'm going to be polite here, but you know what that guy can do for $65. No way. Walked out of his office, never paid him. 5, 6, 7 years later, I'm working the steps again. I'm still in Chicago at this time. I'm working through the steps again, and now I get to this guy. I resented him, and I feared him. I resented him because of what the situation was, and the fear is that somehow I owed him money, that somehow I would run into him or something. And Tom Washington said to me, you've got to go pay that money back. And I said, no way. He said, well, let me just put it to you very bluntly. Pay the money back tomorrow. This was a Sunday that we usually met, no, on Saturday. He said, pay the money back Monday, or you're going to be eating Twix bars before you can say Jackie Robinson. He said, those are your choices. The next Monday, I went to the office. I had $65. I had a 50, a 10, and a 5. Right? Right. Right? Yeah. Okay. Liberty Federal Bank was right next door. I remember that. Anyway, I had a 50, a 10, and a 5, and I didn't see his name on the door. But I did see his daughter running around in the back. Now, you can't do this if you're me without step two. What do you want me to do? Your will, not mine, be done. Your will, not mine, be done. I heard him. I heard God say, go in and do it. I walked in. I don't see anything with his name on it. I don't understand it. I go in. I talk to his daughter, and she tells me that he passed away a year previous. She remembered me. She said, Mine, you've lost a lot of weight. I says, yes, thank you. She says, yes, I remember you. She says, I remember how my father mistreated you. And I made amends, and I paid her back that $65. And she made amends to me on his behalf. And we hugged, and I cried, and I left that office paying him the $65 posthumously. And I got to tell you, that the last thing on my mind at that moment was eating Raisinets. There was no further thought in my head of Raisinets or Doritos or crap. My tires did not touch the ground. I flew home. I have never felt that good up to that point. Test God. Seek Him. Test Him, see if you don't get these miracles. I went years without paying my taxes, years without paying income tax. and I was in radio, different company, and I owed thousands of dollars to the federal government, and they came in with a garnish to get my wages. And the guy that owned the company loaned me thousands of dollars interest-free. And his best friend, the attorney who lived in the John Hancock building, Sonny, he went, and not all attorneys are credentialed to plead before the IRS, but he was. And he pled my case to the IRS, and he got everything straightened out, and then he took hundreds of hours of his time to repair my credit. And he did things for me without a thought of charge. Test God. See if you don't find unbelievable miracles when you least expect them, when you least understand where they're coming from, where you just, it's unbelievable. Unleash the power of the recovery. Don't sit in the power of the crap. And when I say the crap, I mean of just hoping that this is going to happen and just wishing that this could happen. Make it happen through action. Make it happen through doing the work. Roy doesn't sit there waiting for recovery to drop on him from the sky. He goes and he works and he gets it and he does the work. He takes the action. God is an unbelievable force. The program is an unbelievable power. My God, the pain of the fear and the anger and the shame and the degradation that this illness will wrought into a life. No human being could get away with doing that to another human being. I've said this before and I'll say it again. If I did to you what this illness did to me, I would be in a penitentiary. I'd be in Joliet prison tonight. Take this action. Do this work. And follow the dictates of this higher power. Very, very important. It says at the bottom of the paragraph on 76, remember it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. That's another reference back to what I like to call step zero on page 58. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. This is a reference back to that. You have no right to go make amends to somebody if it's going to hurt them or another person. By that I mean, let's just say, for example, you're a man and you've been kissing Fred's wife. You do not have the right to knock on the door and say, Fred, I've been kissing your wife. I'll stop. No, you don't have the right to do that. You make amends by stopping kissing his wife. You take action. You stop. We don't apologize to the Constitution. We amend the Constitution. And to amend means that we change. We stop. It's not an amends if I continue doing it. We do not apologize to the Constitution. We amend the Constitution. And we have no right to involve, harm another person in doing this. One of the lies that you're going to hear in fellowship, not in program, this is the program, the book I'm holding is the program, not the fellowship. One of the lies you'll hear about in the fellowship is that this is a selfish program. That is not true. I'm here to tell you that this is a selfless program. And over and over and over again, we are told to consider others first. That we consider their needs, their wants. We don't just go in and make amends when it's going to hurt somebody else. Excuse me. On page 77 at the top, it tells me something that I need to know. Page 77 at the top is why I was born. Page 77 at the top is something that I write about every day, that I read every day, and that I try to act every day, and so does Roy. Roy lives this sentence. And the reason I love that he's in the room is because he is a living embodiment of what this does for you people anywhere, no matter where you live, but especially here because this is where he's from. Now, in the Oxford Group movement, in the Oxford Group movement, there was an expression of being maximum. And what, when they said, are you being maximum, what they meant was, are you living life to the fullest, not only for you, but for them? And Bill Wilson had this vision. Bill Wilson had this idea that he was going to sober up drunks. Well, the Oxford groupers did not really want the drunks in their midst. The Oxford groupers wanted Bill to go and recruit stockbrokers. The stockbrokers had something that the drunks did not have, money. And the Oxford group was not AA. They wanted money. And they told Bill repeatedly, forget the drunks. They smell. They smoke. They spill coffee. They puke on us. It's unpleasant for us to be in the room with them. And Bill said, but you don't understand. This vision comes to me from God. And they said, go be maximum and recruit stockbrokers. But at the top of page 77, it says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Maximum service to God and the people about us. It begins and it ends with working the steps. He does, I'm pointing at Roy if you're listening on the tape. He doesn't sit there and wait for recovery to come to him. He goes and he gets it and he works and he starts big book meetings and he starts meetings and he goes and he doesn't spread lies and he talks about the recovery when he's in a meeting. He doesn't sit and tell you his romantic story. He doesn't sit and tell you the story of his life. He sits or he stands and he tells you how he works the steps and how a recovery from this illness came into his life through the working of the steps. Okay, now, we don't use this as an excuse. I'm on 77. Shying away from the subject of God when it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. Now, it's much easier. Okay, well, let me just let the paragraph there. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though he may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend. We find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. What step do you think I need to lean on when I'm going to do this? Two. I can't overemphasize the need for a God that I do believe in. It is absolutely paramount to anything that I will ever do. Now, we haven't the time to go over all of the instructions for step 9 in the book because I have to have you out of here by 11 so we can go to the closing ceremony. But let's remember, thank you for being with us. Let's remember that this is not something that we just run through and be done with it. These steps are to be worked every single day for the rest of our lives. No matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. And as a human being, I'm going to have these things coming back. Now, let me just touch on something that's very important before we go into step 10. Step 9 is very important for a lot of different reasons, but it's also very, very important that we remember that Dr. Bob met Bill May 14th, 1935. But we count June 10th, 1935 as the birthday of our fellowship. What happened between those times is important to relate for step 9. Dr. Bob was a drunk. Dr. Bob was sober up until June. In the last 2 weeks of May, in first little pit of June, he was sober, and Ann Smith said to Bill Wilson, "Bill, don't let Bob go to this medical convention in Atlantic City. He goes there, and he gets drunk there every year." And Bill said something to Ann Smith. He said, "Bob lives in a world where there's alcohol. God has either removed his obsession with it or he has not." Do you go to meetings where they say don't talk about food? Do you go to meetings where somebody's going to pass out if you say raisinette or matzo ball or latke or something or whatever? Let me tell you something it says in the big book in chapter 7. Any attempt to shield the alcoholic from temptation is doomed to failure. Okay? If I say raisinettes and you go out and eat raisinettes, guess what? You were going to anyway. If you eat raisinettes because I said raisinettes, you were going to anyway. Okay? Now, Dr. Bob wants to go to this medical convention and Bill will not stop him. And sure enough, Ann Smith knew her husband. He was drunk before he got on the train in Akron. He goes to Atlantic City. He gets drunker. He stays drunk. He comes back drunk. And his nurse calls Ann Smith and says, "My husband found Dr. Bob. He's at our house. He's dead drunk. You better come get him, Annie." Ann Smith goes and gets Dr. Bob, and Bill and Ann sober Bob up. And the next day, this was June the 9th, 1935, the next day was June the 10th, and Bob had an operation that he had to do. He was a proctologist in Akron. I'm glad he wasn't operating on my procto that day. But the bottom line is that he was a proctologist, and he was afraid to do the operation because he says, "Bill, my hand is shaking." And Bill Wilson, on the morning of June 10th, said to Bob, "I'll take you, do the operation, and when it's done, I'll take you back home." And Bill did something for Bob that morning that lots and lots of AA sponsees wish their sponsors would do for them. He gave him a beer to settle him down. He gave him a beer to settle his hand down from the delirium tremens so that he could complete the operation. Bob goes into the hospital. Hours go by, no Bob. Bill's waiting. He finally goes back to Bob's house on Ardmore Street. He goes back to the house, no Bob. Evening comes, night comes. About 11:30 at night, Dr. Bob is walking down Ardmore Street, and Bill and Ann figured that the beer triggered Bob's allergy and that he's off to the races. Here comes Dr. Bob, sober as sober can be. One of the Oxford Group tenets was restitution. Bob was running around Akron making restitution to the people that he had harmed, and he never found it necessary to drink, and he died in 1950, never ever having consumed alcohol even one time between June the 10th, 1935, and 1950, when he passed from our sight and hearing. Now, if that's good enough for Dr. Bob, that's going to be good enough for me. And it's no secret, and it's no coincidence, that the so-called promises of the program come between 9 and 10. Okay? Let's go, if we can, to the bottom of 83. I wish we had a little more time to spend on step 9 with the specific instructions, but we don't, and I certainly don't want Leslie and Ellie beating me up after we're done here, and they have laid the law down with me saying, "Look, Chubby, no keeping the people here from the closing." Okay. All right. See, they look like they're, you know, but they're tough. One holds you and one works you over, and it's a hard situation. Okay. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Here's a promise. They will always materialize if you think about them. No, if you work for them. These are beautiful promises.